I'm interested in this kind of access, this larger access that placing work online has, and also approaching art more as a thing that can be looked at and remastered rather than something that is done and if no one shows it again, no one sees it again. Mm. That to me, I think, is a big loss, mm-hmm. especially when the art is made with a community you care about and for people that you think it should exist for.
Hello and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast, brought to you by the Vienna Business Agency. My name is Severin Matosek, and today's guest is Danielle Brathwaite-Shirley. Danielle is a Berlin-based artist who works with animation, sound, video game development, and performance to create work that seeks to archive Black trans experience. Her work is highly interactive, inviting the audience to make decisions, choose identities, and influence the reality they create for themselves and others. I was always curious about the way Danielle conceives these experiences, what type of games influenced her early on, and her approach to making art. So we met at her studio in Berlin to find out.
So when I was first getting into art, I graduated in 2019. Mm. I made my first piece in the following year that was actually commissioned. And something I was finding out was that there's a very certain demographic of people that can go to galleries or that see shows. And so when I was researching shows, I would see all these amazing shows and have no opportunity to see them. They're all gone. They're all finished. They all ended years before I even knew they existed. So there was this longing that I wish I could have been involved there, or I wish that part of the show could still exist. And then for me, I came to thinking about making it to be accessible, just like video games are accessible in the way that I can access the entire experience at home, whatever I want, and it will always be there. Even if the launch is the special moment, you can still experience what the work is trying to say anytime. And I think that's when I stumbled upon publishing things online, mm-hmm. And making sure that people can access them for a longer duration than actually the show exists, because the network in which art advertises to is a lot smaller and a lot more stuck in that particular time frame and what people are interested in that time frame than actually the interests that are usually accrued by the work existing, mm-hmm. which it changes over the years. And so for me, it's just amazing to make work online and use the internet not as just a place to showcase work, but as a medium itself. And I'm very influenced by these, like, older, from the 1980s, the HyperStax. I don't know if you know the HyperStax
I games. Don't know the HyperStax games, but tell me more yeah. about it. Because I'm very much a 80s, early 90s video game kid as well.
In the 1980s, 1998, I think it was the Apple II came out.
Yeah.
And they had this program called HyperStax, which essentially was a very early version of creating hyperlink pages. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it was very simple and Apple II had a like paint software. Mm. I think it was Macintosh Paint, something like this. A lot of artists started making these silly HyperStack games. Mm. You know, just like it'll be an image, you click on the image, it changes here, blah, blah, blah. And I am someone who's like an avid researcher of these old games, of these old web games, of games in general.
Because you're obviously a bit younger. You didn't grow up in the 80s with the Apple II, right?
No, I was born in 1995. So yeah. I never had an Apple II or grew up with that. But when I look back on that, for me, it's amazing that I could still play them. Mm. Thanks to thearchive.com. And so for me, I'm interested in this kind of access, this larger access that placing work online has, and also approaching art more as a thing that can be looked at and remastered rather than something that is done. And if no one shows it again, no one sees it again. Mm. That to me, I think, is a big loss, especially when the art is made with a community you care about and for people that you think it should exist for.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the HyperStax, is that a foundational medium almost to your work as well. As you said, okay, it was basically Mac Paint, so something visual, plus an early version of hyperlinks of the internet. So one page takes you to the next page. So did you research that and really get into it, and did it inspire the way you structure a lot of your video games and work?
Yes. Yes and no. I didn't research it in a very, like, this is how it worked and I'm going to replicate this, because when I started making video games, I had no idea what I was doing. And no one had any idea what I was doing either. And so to make it was a lot more difficult than just like knowing what the program was and understanding how to program, because I didn't. And so for me, it was actually more about taking a risk on one project and insisting that this project exists online, and that the medium it's used to make it is not disrespecting the online space. And I think something that we saw a lot, especially during this COVID times, was that people don't actually know how to use the internet as a medium because they don't study how people have used it as a medium.
That's interesting.
And so if you look throughout the 1990s, when the internet was new, there's a lot of experimentation with the internet, with these kind of like web pages, using the internet as a medium itself, not as just a means to show physical work. If you make physical work and then you try and translate it to a website, for example, you quickly understand that just putting a picture of the work doesn't feel the same. You lose the sense of what it is. And so you need to do a lot more work, because it's like using a different type of paint. And that's, to me, how I talk about digital mediums and game engines, is I talk about them as paint rather than as just tools as a means to an end. Because when you talk about it like that, you realize that you need to get the essence of what you like, how you like to make those brushstrokes within those tools and within those engines, so that it actually speaks from you to someone else and doesn't become soulless. Because it's very easy to use technology in a very soulless, you do my job way, rather than using it as you would when you're doing a painting, in a very feeling way.
You have basically found a way, or still exploring a way, to use the internet and publishing on the internet as not just a way of making things accessible, but actually using the medium as a way to inject your soul in it, or to connect, really truly connect with an audience.
That's the aim. I don't know if I personally don't think I achieve it. I think each time maybe like they achieve it in a different way, or maybe get close and some fail. That's fine. We can talk about which games I think fail and which games I haven't.
Happy to, but,
but I think for me, it's at least about trying to make it feel very natural. I feel like, especially when you work with tech, you can get so bitty and so lost in the processes. And this happens in painting too, actually. But when you see a big expressionist painting, you feel the expression. You may not even like the painting, but you do feel the expression. And I feel like with tech, especially when you're looking at indie games, the games made where they only had 24 or 48 hours to make, you see the expression of how they're making the game. And sometimes the game is really bad, but the expression is there.
Yeah,
that's what keeps you there. The mood is what keeps you there. And that's what I'm trying to have a balance with, the game being functional and good, but also feeling like an expression, feeling more like a sketchbook, a diary of ideas that you can then draw from yourself.
That definitely shines through. Now that you say it, I think last night I played some of your games. I was like, yes, this is totally there.
That's good.
And I think, and I would say from my personal experience of playing games on the early systems, I didn't have an Apple II either, but I had an Apple Color Classic, which was, I think, the successor.
Ooh, fancy.
Fancy, right? And I do think that these early games had this element where there was a genuine wish to explore certain things of what a game could be. And that was the primary goal. And like the artwork and the visual, it was not as polished as a lot of the stuff we see today, where, you know, with AAA games, hundreds of people working on it for years and years, it's different, right? So do you feel like this roughness, this early experimentation with games is something that feels more inspiring than AAA games, for example?
I feel like, I wouldn't say sometimes they're more inspiring, but I would say that the early games, you can really see that no one understood how to use the medium. So they're all inventing things. And everyone took every approach they possibly could. because they thought the possibilities were endless. So they took the approach of, this is the next step of film. So that's why you had loads of FMV games in the early 90s where they tried to put like film and interactivity together. And then you had a load of people who were like, this is art. This could be a weird mish of stuff. So you get games like The Museum of Everything, which is such a strange, weird... It's a museum. I don't know, I can't describe it. Every scene is just super weird and arty and strange and amazing and creepy. But they were really experimenting with just making sure that you are invested and it feels something, and there were no rules. And so every game was breaking every other game's rules. So you would play one game and it wouldn't help you play the next one at all. And I feel like looking back at that time, you can use some of those techniques to see what actually worked and didn't work with hindsight. And often when we look at these older games, we think, oh, okay, that game is... It's very old, it's very difficult, so I'm not sure how much there is to learn there. But there was a lot to learn there artistically about, okay, very frustrating controls, how does this make you feel? How does it make you feel when the graphics were rendered in this specific program that makes everything look like a doll? Like, things like this are really interesting to understand, and especially when you start replicating some of those techniques, you realize that every one of those engines, especially in the early days where they had literally wrote the engine for every game, is like a piece of art.
Yeah.
And if you look at it that way, just as you would study like a Rembrandt painting or a Gaudi or something, and you were like, let me replicate some of these techniques, let me understand how they were used, then you realize that you can also use some of those skills that someone else has amazingly tested on a larger scale and maybe failed to make something in the modern day that, one, is cheaper to make, but two, has a different effect than a lot of AAA games do. Because a lot of AAA games now follow Hollywood rules of like, okay, so we need to make you scared. So we have a big thing. It's going to be lots of tension, blah, blah, blah. You've got to walk down the escalator and there's going to be a little demon there. You're going to have the little sound. Like, and then in this older games, when you look at horror, sometimes there's no music and it's just still pictures for 40 minutes. And then the sense of dread is so big because it does feel really strange. Everything feels so uncomfortable. And so that there's so many ways I think you can learn from those techniques. So the problem is we just don't see games as pieces of art. And I think that's like a big issue. Even with curators, when I'm trying to say, you've got to see game as pieces of art, and they say, okay, yeah. But what is the right way to play it? And I'm like, no. What's the right way to look at a painting?
Yeah.
There's no right way. If you start just having a little bit more of an open mind about how you look at games, I feel like it really does open your mind to how much information actually is to use within making modern interactive work.
You mentioned that when you started programming, creating your first game, you had very little experience of doing it. You started from scratch.
Yeah,
and you studied all of that.
Well, okay. If we want to go back to the first game I made was absolute failure. No one will ever see it.
Let's talk
again.
About failures now.
So
how did it fail?
In 2019, I showed in Lausanne. I can't remember what this festival's called. It was only for a couple of days or something. And I made this game called Resurrection Lands, which I later remade. And I made it using this Blender game engine because I didn't know how to use anything else.
Yeah. And Blender is normally a 3D rendering program.
It's normally a 3D rendering program, but in Blender, this is how much of a nerd I am, 2.79. It was a rendering engine, but it had a game engine built in. So you could just flip to game. And so the whole scene that you had made, you could then flip to game and add like press W to walk forward and whatever. So I tried to make this game.
Yeah.
And the way I use Blender is like a diary. So I was using it like a diary every day to record my feelings, whatever. Very messy scene.
But so sorry, how do you use Blender as a diary? Like you create 3D objects and that's a sort of personal reflection?
So usually every day I would do a render. At this time I was doing it very specifically like this. Every day I would do a render based on my feelings and I would try and capture those feelings. So I would spend 15 minutes doing a render of... If I was harassed or if I had a really bad day or a really good day, I would do a render based on that. And then I would like write in. There's like a text thing that you can write in the world. So I'd write in something. At the time, I was thinking about taking hormones a lot. I was scared about taking hormones and I was upset at my friends. Very, you know, I was young. And so I was writing in all this stuff. And so when you looked at it, it was very much like a diary. Very messy, very thoughts all over the place. So I tried to make it a game you could walk around and explore. And I showed it in Lausanne. And I quickly realized that when you have a keyboard in an art show, people look at it like it's a piece of art,
mm-hmm.
which is ridiculous. And so everyone came in, oh, nice keyboard. Oh, and they were like doing that thing where they like crane their neck and look around it, which I found like, I obviously just hadn't done much interactive stuff before. And then when they walked forward, they fell through the world.
Mm.
And I was like, fuck. Mm-hmm. So everyone would walk and fall through the world all the time.
Like fall through the world, that means like the world just ends and
yeah, the game would just, they would just suddenly just be black and nothing that I had worked on forever could be seen.
Yeah.
Oh, and it was awful. So it taught me that, okay, this is not working. I'm not doing the right thing. But what was lucky is that while I had made that one, I had the opportunity to work with a coder in the next 2 months.
Mm.
And so when I was making this Black Trans Archive, I rendered, I think it was around like 2 hours of footage, and then just used like the technique of FMV games to splice it all together.
Mm.
An FMV game is like a full motion video game. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially a movie cut up into clips with the interactive points selecting which movie clip to play next.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
Then my next approach was, okay, I know how to edit films. Mm. Like that's how I got into 3D modeling. I'll make a bunch of little films based on the people I've spoken to in this project that I had. And I'll splice them together. And that's what I'll get help from the coder to do. Mm. So I'll get help splicing the videos together. I can make a flow chart. And that was my first approach going into like actually designing a game.
Yeah.
And the world you're exploring is just very interesting and weird as well, which is just me. So I think that was quite lucky that I had this failure, because it really helped me boil down to what I actually could do at the time with only one element that I didn't know how to do, rather than not knowing how to do any of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that since Black Trans Archive, which was built on the first failure, are you working more towards adding complexity and different choices and layers in your games, or is it a mix of a simple FNV dynamic and double down on the artwork or like the world that you're creating?
Yeah. After I made Black Trans Archive, I really got into these FMV games. So I made 3 more.
Okay.
I was just honing down the skills and seeing what they could do and how long people would stay for and all this kind of stuff. So I remade Resurrection Lands as an FMV game in a different way. Then I made another game called Black Trans Sea in a different way. So I kind of was understanding the medium a little bit more. And then I started making these Twine games.
What's a Twine game?
It's mainly like a text game, but you can have images in the background. You can have videos too, but I didn't put videos in. I used GIFs. So it's even stepping further back and just basically focusing on getting the writing good. Because something that I was learning was that the FMV games got better and the more the writing was good. And a lot of the works actually are pretty much text-based.
Mm-hmm.
They just have nice visuals, but there's a lot of text in them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I was thinking as well, okay, let me make a text game and see if like the text can do everything. So I made this game called, I can't remember a time I didn't need you, which was based on one of my friend's deaths actually in New York. So I recreated this kind of like strange city of New York. It was basically in the hopes that if I had created that city, maybe they wouldn't have died. It was really actually helpful because it was the first time I programmed everything. And Twine, hello viewers, if you don't know, Twine is an amazing free engine that you can use. It works on any program. You can even work on it in the browser. It basically makes a website. And the way I used Twine was that I replaced the background with a GIF of a 3D thing. So the limitations were very stringent. The GIFs could only be 10 seconds long. They were based on these very early 90s aspect ratios and amount of pixels, which meant everything was very fast to render, very cheap to do, and didn't take much time at all. I think I made it under 2 months.
Mm.
But also just really allowed me to focus on what makes a good game and how much choice you can actually have and how different things can be. And again, it was based on my experience in Berlin as well. Before you could do anything in the city, you had to go to the registration place and register who you were and where you lived, basically. Just like we do in Germany when you get a Maldong. And so like you had to do that in the game, but you would register your identity and your beliefs and your aim and why you came there.
Inspired by German bureaucracy.
Who would have known? Bureaucracy, and that determined everything that happened later on.
Yeah.
Smell the
I feel like your work oscillates between those two extremes, which one is highly imaginary, speculative world building.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you like the word, so correct me if I'm wrong. Some people. And so you have this kind of very imaginary world. And on the other end, your games really want people to interact, to participate, and to reflect their experience in this world right now. So can you talk a little bit about that dead end of wanting to make people participate, pay attention, and make choices? Because I felt like when I played Black Trans Archive late yesterday, I feel like what the experience tells me is that you need to make choices, and your choices have consequences.
Yeah.
That decides where you go in the game and what your experience is going to be.
Yeah, I would say that there's two mediums happening.
Mm.
So one medium is the game engine and the game. And the other medium is literally the audience.
Yeah.
And I never want someone to leave an artwork saying, oh, that game's cool.
Mm.
Like, I want you to think about the choices that you made.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But for me, it should be about you and your decisions, who you are, and how you got there, and what knock-on effects you might have, which is the reason game engines are so amazing. I put a lot of work into making sure that the choices feel significant. Mm. And sometimes it's at the detriment of actually what the story is, but it's more important that the audience doesn't necessarily start just getting lost in the world.
Mm.
And actually, you can have a choice that makes you pause and start considering, oh, like, who am I? And when you're asking those questions, like, what would I do? Who am I? The work now becomes about you. I do these flowcharts, like these emotional flowcharts. Mm. So there's like a flowchart for the game. There's an emotional flowchart that I want to hit for each choice.
So an emotional flowchart, meaning which emotions you want to evoke?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do it. And it doesn't always work, but I'll be like, okay, so if this person comes with this identity or this mindset, like, what do I want them to feel? How can I hit them? And they get hit in different ways, you know? You can hit emotional resonance in someone who's super pro-trans or someone who never has met a trans person in their life. The way you hit that emotional resonance is quite different.
Mm.
I do an emotional flowchart or for each of those things to try and figure out how to get you to that stage or how to get that lump in your throat or how to have that moment of self-reflection. Because I think for me, the work will essentially loses power when everything just becomes about the work itself, and it gains power when it becomes about you. And when you leave thinking about yourself, it's a lot more interesting than thinking about, wow, that character was really pretty and I'm sad they died. Like, who the fuck cares?
Mm.
But if you say, I feel responsible for that and I wonder who's died in my life.
Yeah.
Then I think that it opens something else in there. And sometimes, like, in I can't remember a time I didn't need you, I had a shrine where you could think about someone that had died in your life. And it just offers a space for you to do that. And that's when the work becomes impactful and less about what you're seeing. That's just all melts away and actually becomes about who you are and what you've been through.
Mm.
And I think the work is moving more and more and more and more in that direction. Because I think, to me, I want people to connect with themselves in a way. That's where the real artwork takes place, but also to eventually, hopefully, somehow connect with each other in the space.
Yeah.
Which is so hard. But that's
so
the aim.
This is a great transition to maybe your recent big show at LAS at Berghain here in Berlin this summer, 2024.
Yeah. Oh my God, I can't believe it.
Which felt to me like I am entering a real world, real life video game.
Right. Great,
right? Starting with, I think you had to register, then you went upstairs, you uploaded your soul, and then there were these screens with little riddles, actually quite hard riddles, where you had to cooperate with other people in the room to actually solve them.
Yeah,
so I felt okay. So can you talk a little bit more about the transition from creating a game that's purely online in a browser window to creating a world that people actually get immersed in the physical world?
Yeah. Oh, God. So like a lot of shows were done between that time that didn't just happen. But I had a lot of tests of making these games that, you know, you play in the gallery. Mm. And most of them were just single player. And what I was learning is that, like, loads of people just watched and they couldn't engage.
Yeah.
And which just happens in the gallery anyway. But I was learning a lot that those people who sometimes watch are really deep in thought.
Mm.
And they sometimes may be the better people to go through that emotional journey than actually the people playing. And the people playing sometimes have this state of mind of, I've got to give you the best experience. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm hoping I'm going to do the right thing. Yeah. Like I'm a leader in this room. I was basing that game off democracy. So that's why you had the Colosseum built in this way. That's why you had a leader in the middle. That's why you could vote on the tablets on the outside.
Yeah, I love that. I was in there trying to be the leader. I can also see that you're asking the audience a lot. Yeah. Like, have you encountered reactions where people are like, no, I can't deal with this. I don't want to deal with this. I'm going out. I don't want to upload my soul. I don't want to face these questions. Yeah. This feels too intimate. Did this happen?
Yeah, there's a bunch of no reactions. So like, some people are just like, I'm here to relax. Why are you making me work? What's wrong with you? That's fine. And so some people don't like that. And some people want to leave. And some people think it's rubbish. Some people think that the games are too janky and they're not polished enough, which I sometimes agree with. I think there's a load of reactions that, to be honest, I like. I like when someone goes to a show and they see that there's an interaction, they do it, and then it's a bit too much. And they say, well, this is too intense. I'm not ready to deal with this explosion that just happened on screen. And then it says, what do you want to bomb next? I'm not ready for that sentence, you know. Or I did this work in Studio Voltaire in London where you had to confront your self-loathing, your addiction, your hatred, all these kind of things. And that one, people were just not ready for it because it was in a horror setting too. So it would make a monster based on your addiction and you had to beat this monster. It was a kind of very intense, scary game. And yeah, like sometimes the responses you get, like people run out the room, they leave. But then at the same time, they like laugh. And yeah, like those responses I like. I like when people say, I'm out.
Yeah.
I leave. Because that's also a choice. And that's a great choice to say, I can't do this. Let me go. That's a really good choice within a show. I think it's quite interesting that sometimes I want people to leave because I think just having the action of saying, no, I don't, like, this is not good enough for me. Like, I made the game where there was the gun and then you have to shoot shoot to protect black trans people. Everyone looks like a monster. But the point of that game is, like, basically don't play it.
Yeah.
And if you don't play it, then you're not going to hurt anyone because using a gun often is going to hurt someone more than save someone else. And so people to not play games or to not interact with the work is also a choice.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little bit meta.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I like that. I like that those aspects of it. Because I just think often when we go to a gallery and see some art, the interaction is so consumerist. Like I'm looking and I'm like, this is so pretty, whatever. Sometimes offense. But sometimes we're trained to come in, to think, to put our references on it, to look in whatever way we want and then leave and then say, I use this artwork and it inspired me X, Y, Z. And I think my works don't really allow that kind of thing as much because they usually have a very clear point of what they want to say.
I want to talk about, you know, you mentioned you are very self-critical with your work. Do you also feel, I mean, since your work is so personal as well, do you feel very vulnerable when you put out something new where you feel like, ooh, this can really go deep also in your own personal space?
Oh, I knew I was going to get called. Sorry. Yeah. I think the reason I'm really self-critical is because, one, they are very personal, and I don't know how to make work that's not, to be honest. I wouldn't know how to write a story that not only did I not care about, but that didn't have a massive chunk of me in it. And yesterday I was doing this talk to a school in New York, like a night class, and I saw the trailer from my own work, and it put me in a really strong emotional state. It was a work I'd made earlier this year that I wasn't expecting to re-meet. I didn't expect that it would do that. Because it's so strange. When I make the work and when I've just released it, I have no emotional attachment to it anymore. And I'm like, okay, it's out and I hate it every time. And it's not a nice, it's not fair, but I always hate the work.
Okay.
And then when I look back on it, it like makes me realize of what the emotional state I was in at the time and what I was going through and how sometimes visible that is in the work. I think for me as a maybe a method of protection, I come at the work from a very critical point of view. And each work has a very particular aim. So I'm like, did it succeed in the aim? Does it make the audience feel sad as I wanted them to feel sad? I have such specific aims for each scene that I can have a yes or no answer for success on those particular things.
Yeah.
And when I see a no, I'm annoyed.
Mm.
And I think, well, I need to do better on that particular front. So for me, my measurement of success isn't necessarily like how big the shows are.
Mm.
It's if the work was good enough to do what I set out to do.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to say like, this work failed.
Mm.
Because for me, it's like an experiment. As the audience is the main medium.
Yeah, it's almost like a social sculpture in a way.
Yeah. Like I am much more interested in the response that people give and what they do in the space than actually if the work is pretty.
Mm.
If the work is pretty, no one cares. I don't care.
Mm.
Like, I'm so sorry, but I don't really care. But if the work hits you really hard, then that's when I care.
Yeah.
Because that's where I feel like that's such an interesting kind of performative element that happens.
Mm.
So I also would say that I would never treat anyone how I treat myself. But I don't know another way. I don't know how people can say like, oh, I love this piece when they're finished with it. I wish I did.
Yeah.
But maybe because it is a very raw and the process is quite raw and quick and fast, then I just don't get the opportunity until later down the line. I like one show I've done.
Okay.
Which is a show I've done in 2021.
Okay. That's what I wanted to ask now. Do you think you'll ever get there, that you like your work?
Maybe when I look back, I'll say like, oh, I like these works.
Mm.
I hope so. God, I hope so. Yeah, there are elements of the show that I think work well.
Mm.
Yeah, for me, I always just think of it as in like, is the purpose served or not?
Yeah.
You know? And out of context, without humans, because it's an interactive practice, the works don't mean anything.
Mm.
And for me, it would be like asking a performer when there's a big group of people that take part in the performance and it's all like strangers meeting each other. Let's look at the work today in your studio with just you, recreate it. It's like, well, bring me 500 people, all strangers.
Mm.
For me, it's the kind of the same thing. It's like I alone, the work doesn't really exist.
Mm.
Even if it's on my computer, it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And without you, it doesn't mean anything. So, that's a big way of saying, I get there one day and I'm like, oh, this is so great. But right now, I just see improvement. And I'm young enough to be harsh on myself like this. And later on, I can be like, all right, fine, whatever.
And I think if you draw the line to the way AAA games or commercial games are being developed, as far as I know, there's many phases that are still called the play tests, where they actually test a game, a beta, an alpha, with an audience to see how they react. Is this a process you would be interested in to like before the final thing goes onto the internet or in a gallery space to actually test it? Or do you already do that?
Yeah, so that's something that happens so much.
Okay.
With playtesting, it's very important. It's so interesting because when I talk about this process of playtesting with other artists, they're like, what do you mean I would show my work to a random stranger and then change it based on their opinion?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, and it's because the way I approach art is I would ask if you were making a painting and you were showing me, well, I'd say, hello, let me see your paintings first. And then I would say, what do you want to achieve with this painting?
Mm.
And if you said, well, I want people to know it's about capitalism, then I would look at the painting and I would give you the most brutal, honest feedback ever.
Uh-huh.
Whether I would be like, this is a line on a piece of paper. No one's going to think about capitalism.
Mm.
Is that okay?
Mm.
But with playtesting, when you test a piece of art, and I'll test everything. I test these drawings. I've tested these drawings a lot already. I'll test everything and then look at the response of the audience to know if the emotional thing is being hit or not, or what drawing hits it, or what goes over the line, and things like this.
Mm.
And so for me, like playtesting doesn't just include the games. It includes all the imagery, includes the sounds, and all this kind of stuff. And we were speaking to a playtester yesterday, actually, because now the playtests are getting a bit more professional.
Mm-hmm.
You just watch people.
Yeah. So maybe to end the conversation, I'm curious about the show you currently work on, because by the time the podcast gets released, probably the show at Serpentine gets put on.
So the Serpentine show will be in September.
Okay.
The whole point of this show, and I'm really delving into just humans here, is to get people to connect to strangers emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
That is the whole aim of the show. everything to do. It's a lot more of a social experiment than the games I usually make. Of course, I've written a whole story and there's a whole bunch of characters and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the game will also control the environment. Mm-hmm. So if you make a choice, you may turn off all the lights in the space. Ooh, mm-hmm. Or you may make it hot. Mm-hmm. Or you may make a smell or fog come out. Mm-hmm. It's a multiplayer game, if you think about Mario Party.
I love Mario Party.
Exactly, me too. But the decisions that you make are like social.
Yeah.
So you build something together and you all get really excited. And it says, hold down the button, hold down the button. You all hold down the button. And the thing that you see is that you've built like a gun. Mm-hmm. And you go, oh, okay. And it says, the first person to let go of the button will shoot the gun. And then it essentially has these social elements to get people to like trust and then hold an emotion. And then the aim is that at the end of that section, the game will fade away and I'll be just looking at you and connecting with you on what that emotional resonance is. Mm. And so you should be able to come into the gallery and be able to select like joy, happiness, depression, whatever you're feeling, loneliness, and then connect based on that. How do we do that? I don't know.
I have
no idea. We have a bunch of ideas. We're digging into like psychologists, neuroscientists, all this kind of stuff. But the whole game is basically to get people to connect with each other and potentially hold a stranger's hand or look at a stranger or tell a stranger that I'm feeling lonely. I've just been feeling very lonely. Things like this. Mm. It's basically just a space to connect and share views, but without the fear of any repercussions of those things and without the worry of feeling stupid or something like this.
Is it something you think that society needs right now?
Yeah. Something I've been thinking about a lot is that I'm not a religious person, but like the thing that churches offer is like a space that people who don't have anything can go. Mm. And I obviously don't want religion in the thing, just because I'm personally not religious, so I don't think it would be right. And I don't want to force religion on anyone. But I think that we don't have spaces where people who are lonely go anymore. Like I wouldn't know where to go if I was feeling lonely. I would probably just phone my friends, but it's still separate.
Yeah.
And I think that we just are in an ever so increasingly polarized world, we're forgetting that even someone that you might hate is still human. And even someone that you really disagree with, you shouldn't suddenly say like everything that they do and their entire existence is worthless. And so I'm trying to get people to reconnect. And I just think it's necessary. The show, I think, will touch on like very hard points, very political points and things like this. And because it has to, and it's not going to get them to connect over those political aspects, but it's trying to get people to look at each other and appreciate them as human and to know that, yes, we may disagree with you, but I can sit with you in silence and hold what happened to you. And I just think we need these spaces. And the reason I'm doing that in the work is that I think that there's not that many spaces that offer that. And art spaces don't feel functional. Mm. And it would be nice that if every time we did an installation, it would actually be a functional space that people could go, not only to see art, but to satisfy some emotional vacancy. So that's the aim. I think it's really hard and almost impossible, which is the only reason I want to do it. Mm. I was thinking, oh, what's the most impossible thing we can do? Strangers connect in 5 minutes. And so that's the aim. There's going to be a load of techniques that we use to do this. Mm. We're studying a lot of how extremism happens, the language of connection, how you make people connect when they don't know each other, what circumstances are there that make that happen, like how people form bonds over trauma and how we can try and make people maybe see outside of those bonds sometimes. And also how the language, we've been looking at a lot of the language of extremism. Mm-hmm. And often like people talk a lot about the hate that is created and around the language of extremism. But also what people don't talk about so much is that within extremist like cultures or like communities. When I say extremists, I don't necessarily mean like terrorists. I mean like people with extreme views of other people.
Mm. That mostly form online, or is it
online? Yeah, mostly form online. Mm. Sometimes formed by an event that happens. Mm. There's many cases. Mm. But what is also present is there's lots of hate, but there's also a lot of familial language. So there's lots of calling people like, you're my brother, you're my sister, you're my kinship.
Yeah.
And that together with the hate is what forms these really tight bonds. Mm. And so we're trying to look at basically how to create spaces that alleviate some of that and allow you to form some of these bonds with people that you may not hold hands with every day.
Yeah.
And you may see as almost against you. But in the end, you need them. In the end, you will literally need these people to survive. And so that's kind of what the whole work is about. It's a lot. And it's going to be very difficult. And I think it'll be a very difficult experience for people too.
Mm.
But I think, to me, it makes the most sense in terms of actually making a work that is actually useful. Yeah, and not just a nice interactive experience that actually has a purpose to go to.
Mm. Well, I can't wait to see it. That was Danielle Brathwaite-Shirley. Danielle's new show will open at Serpentine Gallery in London in October 2025, and you can find most of her work on daniellebrathwaite-shirley.com. This is the Culture and Technology Podcast, produced by the Vienna Business Agency. The Vienna Business Agency supports new companies, projects, and products that develop Vienna's creative industries further.